thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
All right, let's go now. I said I'm going to try and be better than the weather, and that shouldn't be too hard today, but it's hard to get up on a day like this, isn't it? Literally and physically. If you're still in bed, okay, it's 1:09. Get up. It's time to get going. Monday. This is John. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue on social media. I'm WGN King John. Like and follow me there. We're also on Saturdays from 10 a.m. till noon. And we do a pretty swell podcast. It's called The Mincing Rascals. It's judged to be by the Journalists of Chicago as the very best podcast from this fair city. And we thank them for that. It's 1:10. I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about the movie I saw, but we did. And I just mentioned this to Amy before we broke. We went to see First Reformed, the new Ethan Hawke movie. Cedric the Entertainer is in this movie in a dramatic role. There ain't no laughs in this film, let me tell you, kids. Amanda, is it Seyfried? S-E-Y-F-R-I-E-D is how you spell her name. She's really good. Everybody in this movie is really good. Michael Phillips said Ethan Hawke has never been better. Phillips said that it is one of the strongest pictures of 2018. Michael Phillips in the Chicago Tribune. It's a good movie. It's not an upper. It's about this reverend named Ernst Toller, who is the pastor of a small Dutch Reformed church in New York. And you're saying, wow, John, I want to go. So what happens is, I don't know what happens. It's, you know, the movie is so slowly paced that you're not sure if you're seeing a good movie or not. Right? Like it's well done and it's dramatic and it's crisp and it has a style and it has, in you know, it, you can tell that they know what they're doing.
Right. Sometimes when it's slow like that, you're like, was there so much symbolism in that one scene that, like, did I get any of it?
I know.
You're like, this must mean something. She's looking at the butterfly very intently.
Well, and in this particular movie, it's called First Reformed. It's a really good movie. But when we got done, Brenda and I looked at each other like, okay, did we like that or not? But you are halfway through this movie before something happens. It's a 2-hour long movie. And you keep thinking, okay, so now he's at church and he's unhappy and it's quiet and there's not a lot going on and they're planning for the 250-year anniversary of this church and it's a big deal and you know something's going to happen, but it isn't going to happen anytime soon. And then something does happen. And you wonder what's going to happen next. But it's not, I won't say that the pace picks up. And Michael Phillips said, I will not describe the narrative points of the movie. And I think he's smart to do this, and I won't either. Because you really do need to sort of discover this movie in its own time, at its own pace. I'll just say that it's very dramatic. Dark isn't the right word, but it's a heavy, thoughtful film. It's really, it's a dramatic film of the highest order, I'm sure. I'm not a real good judge of these sorts of things, but I'll tell you this. It's one of those movies, too, because at the beginning, when the movie starts, and like there's some opening credits and stuff, there was no sound. And I went, oh, shoot, someone's got to get up and tell them, the sound's not working. But then eventually, like about 2 minutes into the movie, the sound starts to just trickle in. And then you get the normal sound. So I go, okay. That was a thing. I will tell you about the end of the movie this way. You're watching the movie. Some stuff is happening. You're watching the movie. The screen goes black. And then you go, oh.
There has to be something else, right?
There's a mistake. The same thing we happened at the beginning. They had there's a problem here. And then all of a sudden the credits start rolling up. And you go, wow, the movie's over. Huh. And that's when you will look at the person you came with and go, okay, was that a good movie or not? And the more you think about it, the more you go, wow, that was a really good movie. When we told my son Griffin, who produces my show on Saturdays and is watching a movie a day this year, Griff's our sort of movie expert around here, we said, okay, we're going to go see The Reformed. And he goes like this. He goes, okay. Okay. Like, you want to do that? Okay. I'm just telling you, okay, you got to be ready for this. And then he wouldn't tell us anything about it. And that concludes my review of The Reform, the, I'm told, terrific film starring Ethan Hawke. And if Michael Phillips says that was a really good movie and Griffin says that was a really good movie, I'll say that was a really good movie. It was a really good movie. So they're in Singapore getting ready for this summit. I don't know if you've heard anything about it. But at 8 o'clock our time tonight, Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un are going to sit down. The countries will have their first face-to-face diplomatic relations with their leaders in ever. They're meeting in Sentosa, a tourist resort island. Impersonators for both Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un got there first. The Kim Jong-un impersonator was detained by authorities and asked about his politics. That's true. Authorities are allowing no aerosol cans anywhere around the part of the city where the two are meeting. There will be no flares or drones near the negotiating site. Un arrived on an American-made Boeing 747. Symbolism is everything at something like this. Via Air China, which is a country friendly to North Korea. And it's as big a plane as Earth produces for him because he doesn't want to come in on one of those little jets that they've got. He wants to have a big plane like the United States has. So he borrowed a 747 from China. And then he brought in his own limo and his staff, but they all flew on the smaller and less reliable Soviet-made aircraft for North Korea. Dennis Rodman is there, in case you were wondering.
Thank God you let us know.
He says he's there to help both of his friends. Remember, he personally delivered a copy of Trump's Art of the Deal last summer to North Korea, and he hung with Kim Jong-un for a while. Did a little basketball diplomacy. At first, we were all shocked and outraged at what Dennis Rodman did. But then some smarter people than me said, think about this. If the Harlem Globetrotters went to North Korea and were basketball diplomats, we would all say, isn't that great? The world needs more of that. So if crazy Dennis Rodman goes over there, what harm does he do? And I think that's worth thinking about. Anyway, he tweeted to all of the world that he is looking forward to the historic success of the summit and then tweeted, thanks to my loyal sponsors from Potcoin and Prince Marketing. Potcoin is just what you think it is. It's a cryptocurrency if you want to buy marijuana online. And he thanked them on his way to North Korea, to Singapore, for the meeting with the United States and the North Korean leader. The president says he likes Dennis Rodman, but that he was not invited. But I'll tell you what, if that door opens up and out come Trump, Un, and the two translators, and Rodman, then somebody's got some splaining to do. They tell me he will not be in the room. President Trump, Singapore time now, and Kim are set to meet at 9 a.m. Tuesday. So that's tonight, of course, but it'll be 9 a.m. local time Tuesday. But more, I guess, important is to think of it as 8 o'clock tonight is when they'll be sitting down. And then hours later, the President of the United States is scheduled to leave. So all of this to meet with Kim Jong-un for what they say would be 2 hours. And then Donald Trump is set to get on a plane and head out of there. They say it's possible, depending on what happens in there, that he could stay an extra day. But the meeting will be with Kim, Trump, and two translators. Trump offered that he'll know if the meeting is going to be fruitful in the first 60 seconds. He'll walk into the room and he'll immediately get a vibe. His gut will talk to his brain, and that, he said, will really sort of predicate what the next 2 hours will be like. You and I do that all the time. You and I do that all the time. Therefore, the toughest job may belong to the interpreters. When the president of South Korea traveled to Washington to meet President Bush, George W. Bush, then president, said how much, quote, I appreciate this man's leadership. I appreciate this man's leadership. That was George Bush talking about the leader of South Korea when the South Korean president came to the United States. And so they're pals. And President Bush said, I appreciate this man's leadership. Translated into Korean, this man is too casual and blunt a description for the South Korean leader and was seen as shockingly rude. There's George Bush just kind of winging it casually the way he could. He said, I really like this guy. And this man is not the way you address a leader of South Korea. No one knows if Kim Jong-un is fluent in English. As a child in Bern, he was educated in the German language. He also studied English. In school, his classmates remember that he was more interested in video games than English. though he did decorate his room at school with Chicago Bulls memorabilia. The USA Today says North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un dispatched decoy planes from Pyongyang to thwart anyone who might try to attack him. So he flies off on his Jumbo 747, but there were a couple of other jets that took off from Pyongyang. I don't know if they had the impersonator on the plane or not, but you weren't sure which plane to attack, maybe. They say he packs his own food when he travels. He doesn't travel much, but he's a little paranoid about that, so much so that he brings his own toilet. The regime dispatched a commode to, quote, deny determined sewer divers insights into the supreme leader's stools, according to a newspaper in South Korea. Boy, that's a bit of spycraft I'm not interested in.
People come up through the toilets?
Not exactly sure how they do that. Or they tap the plumbing of the hotel. But then how would you know, oh, never mind. Note that for his April meeting with the South Korean president, Moon Jae-in, the North Koreans dispatched their portable toilets. So when the North Korean leader met with the South Korean leader, the North Korean said, great, it's good to be here. I've got this suitcase, I've got a couple of handbags, and we've got our own toilet.
You don't want to forget to pack the toilet.
I know that, but it's sort of like I can just see somebody trying to put that in the overhead. I've gone to the bathroom in portable toilets. Hotel toilets are much nicer. Even in Asia, I can't believe that a portable toilet would be an upgrade.
I swear, it fits in the overhead. Just give me a second.
He brought his own pens and pencils to the last international meeting he had, Kim Jong-un. And his staff would wipe off anything he touched so as to not even leave a fingerprint. I'm not sure if that's them not wanting evidence of him behind or them being afraid that he's going to pick something up. But anything he touches gets wiped down, I guess, afterwards. So that would mean you just aren't going to get so much as a fingerprint from this guy. Details for planning the event cover everything. So this is weird, too. I mean, at the end of the day, you got to get two people in the room with some number two pencils and some lined paper, and then they're going to have a conversation about nuclear weapons. But I'm telling you, the details about beverage and food selections and where the chairs get placed, that happens. A few of those fascinating details in a minute on WGN. Watched the Tonys last night? 525,600 minutes. How do you measure a year? How about the students from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School singing on the stage at the Tonys, brought the house down, standing ovation. That's a great song. It's a great show.
Goosebumps.
Those kids just nailed it.
That song does something to me, though, every time.
You know, I forgot how much I loved that song until last night. It's a great song. It's a great message. We need it again. We need it always. And their delivering it was just such a smart, thoughtful idea. Props to everybody involved in that. And those kids are good. Back to North Korea for just a second. Singapore, that is. Details for planning the event cover everything. For instance, President Trump does not drink alcohol. If they do a toast, they had to work out with negotiators what would be in the glasses when they hoist them. Say things go well. And they go, all right, champagne for, oh, gee, can we get some juice? So you've got to have, in order to avoid that awkward moment, and my understanding is that Kim Jong-un is pretty westernized, so he may drink alcohol. Here's another thing. Who pays for the rooms? Have you heard about this? North Korea doesn't like to pay for stuff when they're on the road, sort of like Donald Trump. Here's what happens. They say, look, if you invite us, then you are the host.
So therefore, you should pick up the accommodations. So for instance, when North Korea made that famous appearance at the Olympics in South Korea, remember Kim Jong-un's sister was there? Mike Pence wasn't having any of it. You remember all of those scenes? There's a whole bunch of North Koreans there. Well, South Korea picked up the tab. It cost him $225,000 for that photo op for the North Koreans. When the North Koreans then went to the Paralympics, South Korea was on the hook for another $125,000. $125,000. North Korea's like, hey, you asked us to come. That's on you, babe. So now we both go to Singapore. Well, who picks up the tab there? Because it's not our home turf. They're the ones that invited us initially, but Singapore is hosting it. As I sit here now, I'm not exactly sure who's going to pay their bar bill, but I know that they don't want to be stuck with that. Singapore is picking up a lot of the costs. Optics are everything. Who enters the room first? Does Donald Trump come into the room where they're going to meet first? Or does Kim Jong-un? You want to be the last person. You don't want to be sitting there waiting. That's seen as lesser of a role. The guy that enters last and then everybody says, okay, now we're good to go. That's the guy you want to be. And that might actually want to be Kim Jong-un. He might be more tied to that imagery. Donald Trump is famously casual in his dealings with other officials around the world and businessmen and women alike. So maybe he'll pass on that. Even though optics matter to Donald Trump, you can imagine him saying, fine, let's just get in there and hammer this thing out. I'll know in 60 seconds if this is going to work anyway. And speaking of optics, what about the Kim Jong-un security detail? The jogging men in the black suits with the white shirts and the black ties? Oh, are those guys cool or what? I want to be so important someday that I've got 12 men jogging around my SUV so that they'll take the bullet rather than me. And I'm not sure that that's exactly what that's about. I mean, they're trained in martial arts and marksmanship. They have to be a certain height and athletic fit. They can't be taller than the leader, but they need to be on it. And those guys look dynamite. I mean, they could be a dance team. They really look terrific. So they are a certain type of person. You know, you have to serve in the services in North Korea if you're a citizen anyway. And then they handpick those individuals. They're not asked. They're handpicked to be in that security detail. They vet their families two generations back. They are almost always related to Kim Jong-un, his family, or top-ranking political officials. And they jog alongside. President doesn't have that. He's got a security detail, but you don't see. Maybe you do, but I don't remember seeing the president's black limo going down. And then in unison, 12 guys just jogging along and looking like they should be in a dance video. So at 8 o'clock tonight, they will, Chicago time, sit down Tuesday morning there, and we'll see what happens here. It's 1:30, almost 1. Let's pause. We'll update you on the news. That's next on WGN. 1:39. Thank you, Eric. John Williams here in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. In the next half hour, after 2 o'clock, we'll talk about that story that Eric led his newscast with in Ohio. It will be more difficult to stay registered, if you will. There's a lot of ways to read this, and the Supreme Court has said that what they did in the state of Ohio is okay. It is legal. And so will other states follow suit? Who gets registered, how they get registered, and how you stay on voter polls? And if you are not registered, does that matter? All of these questions come into play. We'll talk to the reporter in Ohio who knows most about that. That'll be a little after 2 o'clock. We will catch you up on that. And if there's any other news that breaks locally or interglobally, we will keep you posted on that as well, including preparations for the summit that we were talking about in Singapore between North Korea and the United States. So John McKinnon's in our studio. He is with the Elmhurst Art Museum. He's the executive director. Maybe you saw in the Tribune Blair Kamen's review of what they've done over there, and it's a nice review. Welcome to the show. Welcome to the studio. How are you?
Thank you. Thank you. I'm great.
Tell us a little bit about the Elmhurst Art Museum. What's that?
Sure. The Elmhurst Art Museum is essentially a sort of three-part mission. We have a key piece of architecture that we'll probably talk about a little more today, but we also have temporary exhibitions and a strong education program.
Mies van der Rohe did what for you guys?
Originally he built a single-family home in Elmhurst in 1952. which is a very unique thing. Then later on, the museum purchased that and moved it to a kind of museum campus in the 90s.
Vendera wasn't a residential architect, though, was he?
He began that way, as many architects do, although we know him here in Chicago as building some of the great skyscrapers and defining the city.
What are some of his notable buildings or projects?
Sure. The one that came just before the McCormick House was 860-880 North Lakeshore Drive, very key apartment buildings on the lake, and that sort of came early on as other things developed. He has many other buildings.
What does his stuff look like? How would you describe it?
Oh, very good. Yes. It is all steel and glass, and today we kind of take that for granted.
The right? Modern skyscraper.
Exactly.
That's Mies van der Rohe's vision.
That was what he paved the world with, yes.
You're right. We do take that for granted. That's what tall buildings look like. But that prior to that, they might have looked maybe more like the one we're in right now, which ain't bad, but he had this more modernist, simplified sort of look.
Exactly. Less is more.
Yeah, which is the way Blair Kanin actually described what you all had done. But then he'd built a house in Elmhurst now prior to all of this, but still, I don't know what a Mies van der Rohe house would look like. What does it look like?
Sure. There are only three Mies van der Rohe homes in the U.S. He had actually built some others in Europe before he came over. But the one that everyone knows is Farnsworth House. Very sleek, very large panes of glass, and a kind of singular masterpiece out in Plano, Illinois. This one in Elmhurst is a little different. It was a prototype for prefab housing.
No kidding. They were going to build a lot of these?
Correct, yeah. There were neighborhoods and towns that were kind of targeted. Bensonville, Melrose Park, even Lake Forest.
They were going to be van der Rohe neighborhoods.
Yep.
Didn't happen, though, did it?
No, it didn't. But it's an interesting story and an unknown story in his career.
So, I used to live in Plano, Illinois. Isn't that funny? Actually, I lived in Sandwich and worked in Plano. There's another town nearby called Yorkville, S-P-Y, and my first radio station was W-S-P-Y, or as we called it, Spio Radio in Plano, Illinois. And I knew of the house but didn't visit it. Is it similar, kind of sleek? That's weird, too, because that's farm country.
Sure.
There are cows living out there, man. And not knocking you, Plano, but I'm just it's weird that this architectural visionary would have found Plano as a place to build a home, huh?
Yeah, well, a lot of people don't realize that there are a lot of unique modern homes in the suburbs and even in far-reaching places like Plano that were seen as kind of pilgrimages. We think of like Frank Lloyd Wright building Falling Water, Philip Johnson building things in New Canaan, Connecticut, all these kind of places outside of the city center.
When you were describing what his house would look like, it sounded a little Frank Lloyd Wrightian to me. How similar or dissimilar would a Frank Lloyd Wright house be from a van der Rohe house?
It's funny you ask. There are actually two of, there's a Frank Lloyd Wright house and a Mies van der Rohe house, both in Elmhurst. And we're doing a walking tour very shortly as a part of some of our upcoming programs. So we'll be able to connect those two visionaries and also compare and contrast them.
So you've just opened this Mies van der Rohe house in Elmhurst up to the public?
We reopened it. It used to be connected to the museum. We disconnected it. It's now a freestanding structure, and you can really kind of see and appreciate the full exterior for the first time in 25 years.
Is it, describe it to me in terms of how I would sort of relate to contemporary real estate. How many square feet does it have? Does it have a nice front lawn? Does it have central air? What are the windows like?
Yep.
That sort of thing.
Sure. So it has about...
Because I'm in the market, and I'm... I'd love to live there.
Or buy a prefab version, yes.
You know, we'll go back to that, but go ahead and describe this property for me.
It has about 2,000 square foot in the inside.
2,000, yeah.
Which is interesting, especially once you realize, one resident that lived there had six children. No basement, nothing of that nature, so very crowded.
Oh, it's a ranch style, if you will.
Correct, yep. Sits on a regular platform, and that was one of the engineering feats that they hoped to use for the prefab. Lay a slab and then put this down.
So no basement. Does it have a second story?
Nope.
Huh. Well, 2,000 square feet just rolling along, that's... you could do worse.
That's right.
Okay, so what else is... how many bedrooms? How many baths?
There are four bedrooms, two baths.
Yeah.
One distinguishing factor is that there's a parents' wing and there's a children's wing.
Nice.
And in the original design or original family that that lived there. They had maids' quarters over with the children.
No kidding, yeah. And then a moat in between, which I think a lot of us would like to have. So, again, people had been able to see it before you separated it from the museum. So what's different then? Is it just that the restoration is complete?
Correct, yes. We restored the exterior. The interior is not in its exact configuration and does need some work on the finishes and other touches, and we'll do that in the future.
What's the bill on this bad boy?
Thank you. Yes, a lot of people ask. In terms of restoration projects, it's fairly modest, but it's still $350,000.
To get it to where it was today?
Correct.
Yeah. Is there any interest? I think I know the answer to this, but would you all sell it? Has anybody approached you and said, I want to live in the Mies van der Rohe house?
It would be interesting to have, say, an artist in residence or something, because we are an art museum, but no, we're not interested in selling it.
Yeah, I wonder what that would go for, though. Entertain me. $1 million? $500,000? $350,000? Is it paid for? Are you guys upside down?
No. It was paid for in the 90s, so I don't have any figures.
Yeah, and how? I mean, it would be almost impossible. I mean, how do you do that anyway? So then, would the prefab houses have been similar to this, would you say? Or probably smaller versions, huh?
This was a deluxe version, right, that they used as a prototype and took pictures of. And the McCormicks lived there, but also tried to use it as a kind of, photo of what you could have.
The McCormicks live there. Which McCormicks are we speaking about?
Robert Hall McCormick III. His wife, Isabella Gardner. Interesting. She was related to the Gardner family in Boston, and they had several children that lived there.
Huh. And was that seen as a marquee address at the time? Because Mies van der Rohe, you said, hadn't made his mark yet as the skyscraper visionary. Mm-hmm. But was that seen as kind of a coup to have a van der Rohe house at that time?
Yeah. In fact, McCormick was part of that plan, right? He and Grunwald, the famous developer that worked along with Mies almost his entire career in the U.S., developed 868-80, and McCormick had owned part of that land, so that was another reason that he was involved. And as they were finishing up that project, they turned to Mies and said, what's next? What can we do?
You know, they say Chicago embraces its architecture. You know, I'm here every Saturday doing a show, and it's just fun to see all of the tourists that are here, especially on weekends, Monday through Friday as well. They do the architecture boat tour. They're walking around, and their eyes just go up to these buildings, and they're just in awe. But the great architecture of the Chicago area doesn't stop there. Elmhurst, Oak Park, et cetera, et cetera. Plano, for crying out loud. I really think we're lucky to live here, and I think how great it is that people like you and the Elmhurst Art Museum, am I saying that correctly?
Correct.
The Elmhurst
yes.
Art Museum, are sort of embracing that, not taking it for granted, you know, making it even better and ready for the next generation. So how do I see this then? What do I do to go through it?
Sure. You come out to the museum, Elmhurst, Illinois, and we're open, you know, Tuesday through Sunday, regular museum hours, 11 to 5. Otherwise, now you have to walk outside of the museum door and into the house.
Well, that's the way it was intended, too, right?
Correct. Yeah. Correct.
John, it's nice to meet you. Good job. And nice review by Blair Kamen in the newspaper yesterday. A-minus, was that the grade you got?
That's what someone said.
That's not bad. It's 149, so that is in Elmhurst. What's the website, too, by the way? Do you know that off the top of your head?
Sure, elmhurstartmuseum.org.
Huh, funny. elmhurstartmuseum.org. John McKinnon is with the Elmhurst Art Museum. He's the executive director there. What did she just whisper in your ear?
She said to mention the convenience of going out to Elmhurst on the Metra. It's only a couple blocks away.
What is she, a PR lady or something?
That's right.
Yeah, no kidding. I'm a big Metro fan, too. John, thanks for coming in. Congratulations. Well done.
Thank you so much.
It's 150 on WGN. Something happened at the Tonys last night.
Ladies and gentlemen, Robert De Niro.
Uh-oh, this isn't going to go well.
Here comes Robert De Niro.
Hey, he looks great. Big smile.
I'm going to say one thing.
All right, how about that? You know what I think is notable about what happened last night? And this goes... This... This goes 36 seconds. Yeah, I think what's notable is not what De Niro said last night, but that the crowd gave it a standing ovation. I hate to see, and I get it, you know, I'm not going to say that De Niro did the right thing or the wrong thing. If ever there is a safe place in the world to say that on a big stage, it's at the Tonys, right? If you want to get a standing ovation for that kind of language, say it at the Tonys. But I hate to, it's sort of like with Samantha Bee. I don't want to go there. I don't want to, when they go low, I want us to still go high. And I can imagine everybody's outrage and confusion about the things that come out of our president's mouth and thumb these days, and you're just embarrassed or angry or upset or whatever it is that you are, and so you just want to say that, and maybe you do to your friends, maybe you do to yourself, but I don't know that I don't know that I entirely embrace the idea, even though it's going to get a big laugh and it's going to get a standing ovation. If De Niro had said to me, hey, John, I'm thinking about doing this, what do you think? I would have said, nah.
He's still the president of the United States of America.
That's
our president, whether you like it or not.
That's the go-to response, Violetta. But that, to me, doesn't seem... But that's not where I'm coming from on this, because I think this president so disrespects the office of the presidency. This president so disrespects civility. This president so disrespects the truth.
But just because he's disrespectful doesn't mean you have to be disrespectful.
Well, that's it. So I think, so that's it. I don't want to get to that level. So it's not like I need to respect Donald Trump. It's not even about the presidency. It's more about me. I don't want to be down there. I don't want you to go there. Standing ovation. Standing ovation. I kind of looked, and maybe there was 19 conservative Christians there. I don't know what their description would be. I don't know who the people are that didn't stand, but there were probably some people there that didn't stand, but I did not see them. They were on their feet as he said that. Now, it was bleeped on American television, but in Australia it was not. And I'm sure this had something to do with the G7 summit, right? That on the heels of that thing, people were just like, oh, for crying out loud, are we 11 years old still, et cetera, et cetera.
It's also just low-hanging fruit. Like you said, if you were going to do it somewhere, the Tonys, you knew you were going to get a standing ovation.
Yeah.
So, I mean, did you really need that standing ovation? I don't.
Two words, he summed up the views of a lot of people. In two words, he summed up the views of a lot of people. Hey, look at that. All of our phone lines are ringing. I don't have time for calls right now. I really don't. We'll pause here for the news. We'll let you comment on this later on if you like. But I'm interested in reading your texts right now. 312-981-7200. De Niro says that. What do you say about De Niro? 312-981-7200. Attaboy, thank you. Felt good? Or no. They go low. We should go high. I just wonder what your reaction was to that. Kevin, the White Sox, go. How good are they?
Much better as of late.
How about that?
They beat one of the best teams in all of baseball. They took. They won the series in Boston.
And we won the series in Milwaukee, or against Milwaukee.
That's right. And the starting pitching is what's been kind of the turnaround over the past couple weeks here. All weekend it was great pitching. Dylan Covey did well. Reynaldo Lopez pitched well. So
we beat Chris Sale for crying out loud.
Dylan Covey beat Chris Sale Friday night. That was something.
Yeah. I woke up the next day and went, really? Did that happen?
They're fighting. They're playing.
That's all. And, you know, they're going to lose a lot more games than they're going to win. But isn't it nice to see this team getting better? Because it ain't going to be fun if they don't. And slowly but surely, they will.
Yeah, they're playing better. And I think the exciting thing, too, for Sox fans is you're going to see some call-ups eventually this year. Michael Kopech? That'll be fun.
Yeah. I don't want to rush him. You know?
They're not going to rush.
We don't need him this year. So let's get him when he's ready. If he's ready, if he's soup yet, fine.
He's kind of dominating down there.
Is he really?
Yeah. Rick Hahn's going to talk today to general manager. Maybe we'll have some more news there.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Yep.
Here's John Williams.
It's a living. 207. This is John. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. Appreciate you tuning in. We're here weekdays 1 till 3. And then on Saturdays, we punch the clock from 10 a.m. until 12 noon. On social media, it's WGN King John. I want to be king someday. I think things will go a lot better when I become king, but it hasn't happened yet.
Well, it can't get worse.
By the way, do you have access to the text messages that we're getting?
I do. Okay, we're getting a lot.
We don't here. So let's do this. So I've got a conversation I really want to have. Is our guest going to be able to join us now, by the way? Richard Wolf, Supreme Court correspondent, USA Today, supposed to be on here. If our guest is on, we'll do them afterwards. If our guest can't make it right now, then we'll do it right now. But we asked you to at least text to us what you thought about last night at the Tonys when Robert De Niro dropped the F-bomb on President Trump. twice and got a standing ovation for it. That's not going high when they go low, kids. And I wondered what your reaction to that was. Maybe you thought, oh, thank God, I needed that after the G7 and just everything. Ha, that a boy, thumbs up, or, oh, for crying out loud. So I'm wondering where you were on that. You can text to 312-981-7200. Okay, our guest is going to move to a quiet place, and then we'll have him on. So in the meantime, you want to read a couple? Are people generally in support of what De Niro said or not?
It's a mixed bag. A lot of people saying not my president, keeping it simple. Then others saying, you know, 312, go high, go register to vote. I want the Tonys to just not be political, and I want to hear about the plays. No one likes the president more, less than me, but De Niro went too far over the top. 773 says, what would you say to people in other countries when they ask about character of the United States president? The world is watching, and we need to be better.
Yeah.
I think when I first saw it, I kind of chuckled immediately. I was like, oh, that's kind of funny. And then you take a step back, and it's kind of what you guys have been saying. It's like, really?
This isn't good.
Do we need this?
Really?
On this stage, we're going to have war of words between top actors and celebrities and our president? Come on.
If you were going to guess, though, who would deliver that, the Tonys would be the place.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But De Niro doesn't seem, I don't know, I've never seen De Niro really be outspoken. Maybe I just haven't caught that. Does he typically take a political
stance? When he walked onto stage, I didn't think, oh, boy, he's here it comes. No, I didn't see that coming. I didn't see that coming. And there, you know, there's some political statements. And who was it that said, you know, everybody just go bake a cake. Let's all have a cake.
708, way to go, De Niro. 630, the Tonys were on.
Well, look, right, so this may not be your cup of tea, but I think in that audience and on TV, the people watching that were attuned to the Tonys, and if you had to guess which of the four majors would find the most sympathetic audience for that kind of a comment, the Tonys would be it.
Now, as we're reading comments against this, comments for it are definitely coming in. 815 says, two thumbs, F up.
Yeah, right. All right, you can text, and we'll take some phone calls, too, at 312-981-7200 before we get done. I also want to talk about the United States Supreme Court decision about Wrigley Field, mind you. But before we do that, let's talk about the Supreme Court saying that the states can purge voters who do not vote or respond to warnings. Have you been following this? It's a little confusing to me. Richard Wolf, I think, is going to be able to explain it. He's in Ohio and writes for the USA Today. Richard, it's John Williams. You are their Supreme Court correspondent. Welcome to the show.
Hey, how are you?
Good. So tell me, first of all, what were they doing in Ohio? What even got this to the court?
Well, it goes back to the age-old question of one side saying there's too much voter fraud and the other side saying there's too much voter suppression. And each states administer their own election rolls, and each state has their own rules for when they consider somebody to be an inactive voter, when they suspect that somebody has moved. And states are under federal direction to keep their voter rolls clean. In other words, to not have dead people voting, et cetera. But on the other hand, they're also under federal direction to make voting as easy as possible for people. And so those kind of go against each other. And Ohio has a pretty strict law. Ohio has a law that says if you don't vote in one federal election, we're going to send you a notice because we're already suspecting that maybe you moved. And if you don't return the notice, which most people don't because they mostly throw it out, then if you don't vote in two more elections, that does get confusing, I know, 6 years, we're just going to knock you off the rolls at that point. And it sounds like that might be reasonable, but that's actually the most strict such law in the country. And so it was challenged by civil rights groups who said, you're trying to, you know, you're just basically going after people without any real knowledge of whether they've moved or not. And who's most likely to not return these notices, and who's most likely to have moved over a period of time? It's the poor, it's minorities, it's people with disabilities, et cetera. And so the bottom line that they charge is that it's affecting those groups disproportionately, which they don't make this point, but that would mean it affects Democrats more than Republicans. So mm-hmm. It became a pretty controversial case.
Yeah, I understand. Well, in the United States, help me with this a little bit. You have certain inalienable rights. You know, we all get to vote. We have freedom of speech. We have freedom of religion. And you don't have to come up with a card to do that. You don't, if you are living here as a citizen of the United States, and the presumption is that you are, you don't have to demonstrate that either. You don't have to say, hey, I get to say this, here's my badge, I have an identification card, and I get to speak freely or go into the church of my choice. We have certain things that we guarantee and we protect to our citizens. And another one is the right to vote, with some restrictions, right? You can't be 14. But we really do need to protect the broadest interpretation of your right to vote. Now, that's not me. That's not a liberal ideology. That's the way the Constitution is designed. That's why it was written the way it was written, around this. So I'm on the side of protecting people's rights to vote as unfettered as possible.
And that includes the right not to vote. And it's actually interesting, the right not to vote is what's sort of at the center of this case. The case is not a constitutional one, I should say. So regardless of what the Constitution has to say, this case focused on two federal laws. One was called it was the Motor Voter Law back in 1993, and the other was the Help America Vote Act of 2002. And these two laws basically are a little bit contradictory because, as I said, they on the one hand try to make voting as easy as possible, and on the other hand, they do direct the states to try to maintain up-to-date clean voter rolls. And so, in a sense, this case came down to whose right is it not to vote? And the liberals, who were in the minority, the four liberals said, well, just because somebody doesn't vote in a given federal election, why should they be immediately suspected of having moved? And it turns out some of the statistics in the briefs that were filed show that far more people don't return the notice than who have actually moved. And so if you don't vote, you don't return the notice, and you don't vote again twice more, the likelihood still is you haven't moved, but the state's going to assume you have. And so that becomes the issue. But the five conservatives on the court said, we're not here to judge whether that's the best policy or the most fair policy. We're just here to say, do those two laws passed by Congress, I'm sorry, did Ohio abide by those two laws passed by Congress? And the answer they came to was, yeah, they abided by that law. If you want to change the law, Congress ought to do it.
Well, what happens, though, if I'm no longer on the registration rolls there in Ohio? Does that keep me from voting in an upcoming election?
The two things would apply. One is you might be less aware that there even is an election or how to go about voting, or let's assume you know there's an election, but usually it's the people who are registered who are getting notices saying, here's where you want to vote, et cetera. So you're not going to get that notice if they've knocked you off the rolls. But presuming that you do know that it's an election and where to go, you would have to re-register. You're going to show up and they're going to say you're not registered. They're going to give you the opportunity to re-register, but you'd have to go through that process.
But how onerous is that? I mean, in some states you can register the day you vote, right?
Right, right. Same day registration. So that's true. I imagine, and I'm not sure about this, that there are states where when you show up to vote, if you haven't voted in 6 years and they've knocked you off the rolls, and again, this applies only to Ohio, but there are states that are similar. Pennsylvania has a similar law. Georgia has a similar law. West Virginia. So there are a few. Presumably, there are some states where if you went to vote and you weren't registered, you'd have a pretty hard time. You'd probably have to cast a provisional ballot. And they'd always let you do that, but that means maybe, maybe not, that ballot will be counted. And I suppose when you re-up your registration, it would be counted.
Richard
Wolf. Yeah, it's just an extra layer of hassle.
Richard Wolf is a Supreme Court correspondent for the USA Today. Do we have much evidence of voter fraud in the United States, people voting twice or people paying other people for their votes?
No, we don't have much evidence of that. And ironically, in this case, you know, what the focus of who are the people we're talking about in this case? They are people who haven't voted recently. That's what triggers this Ohio law. Gee, you didn't vote. Well, those are probably the last person you would think would be fraudulent because they're not voting at all. They're not even voting for themselves.
Yeah.
So it's not really a law. It's not really a law that it's not really a process that applies to the issue of voter
fraud.
Well,
then why are they busying themselves with this? If I didn't vote, maybe I didn't care for either of the candidate, or maybe I was sick that day, or maybe I'm a lazy American. I think I'm right about this. I think in the last election, more than half of the people eligible to vote did not. Think about that. So Americans just don't like to vote. Why does Ohio care what my voting history is?
Well, Ohio, like every other state, has a mandate to keep their voter rolls as clean as possible so that the voter rolls don't become severely outdated with people who have moved or who have died, et cetera. So that's the basis for it. But the federal law prohibits states from using not voting as their reason to kick people off the rolls. So what the Ohio law does is it says, we're going to use not voting as the trigger to send the notice. The notice shows up, and some people might think it looks like, you know, the type of mail that you throw in the garbage before you open it.
Yeah, right.
And that notice is really what Ohio says is causing the person to be knocked off the rolls. And even then, when they don't return the notice, they're going to wait four more years. But the reason, you know, you ask about the reason in general. The reason in general is states do have to try to maintain a clean, quote-unquote, clean voter roll, which basically means who they say is registered is actually registered, not dead, still living in the state, et cetera. So that's the basis.
Well, this isn't an issue for us in Illinois here yet, but I understand your point about how something like this could trickle down. But it's also not maybe as it's not the crisis that it sounds like on the headlines sometimes, because aren't you saying that it would take 6 years for this to be triggered?
Yeah, and here's what's relevant about why now. A lot of the this challenge came from a person who had voted in 2008. Well, what was 2008? It was that historic election of Barack Obama. Then the person didn't vote in the 2012 federal election, and he didn't vote in the 2010 and 2014 non-federal elections. And then in 2015, in Ohio, he wanted to go vote on a referendum about marijuana. I think he was actually opposed to marijuana legalization and wanted to vote that way. But it had been 7 years since 2008. And so what he found was he was no longer registered. And I think that's somewhat relevant here because there was an uptick in voting, particularly among some populations, generally speaking, minorities, the poor, et cetera, for Barack Obama in 2008. And then some of those people lost interest. Many of them might not have voted again in 2012. And after 6 years, those are the people who are finding out, gee whiz, I voted in 08, but I'm not registered in 2015 or 2016.
Okay. Do you have any one last thought for you, Richard, and then I'll let you go. Do you think other states are going to follow suit, pass similar laws, now that they feel like they passed the muster here?
Well, you have liberal public interest groups claiming that that could be the case and warning against it. I don't know that that's necessarily going to happen. I think the immediate impact beyond Ohio is on the five or six states with similar laws. In other words, states that start their purging of the voter rolls process based on not voting. And I think it basically allows those states to continue to do what they do. And there's some important elections coming up in some of those states. So if indeed this helps Republicans and hurts Democrats, which I think is a pretty reasonable argument, then it could have an impact on some pretty important races. There's a race in Georgia this fall for governor. There's a race in, not Pennsylvania. Well, maybe this Pennsylvania, I think, has a Senate race. West Virginia has a very important Senate race. So it could have that kind of effect immediately. Longer term, I don't know. I don't know if you'd have other states rushing to do this. And if they did, the Supreme Court has said it can't be discriminatory. You can't be doing it with discriminatory intent. So they'd have to show that suddenly they just have chosen a different method of cleaning up their voter rolls, and I'm sure they'd be brought to court and they'd have to prove that it wasn't done with a discriminatory intent.
Nice to talk to you today, Richard. We appreciate your writing. You can read it in the USA Today. Supreme Court states can purge voters who do not vote or respond to warnings. We appreciate you coming on with us this afternoon.
Anytime. Have a good day.
Yeah, you too. It's 2:22 on WGN. I see that a lot of you are on hold. You want to talk about Robert De Niro in a minute. Phone lines in 60 seconds, that could include you, 312-981-7200. I'm asking you, when when De Niro went low, did you say hi, or were you sorry that he did? 312-981-7200. One tiny Illinois community isn't just broke. It's been called one of the poorest in the country. Are things getting any better? WGN-TV investigates that tonight at 9. You know a struggling, suffering young person who could use some strength and guidance right now. I'm talking about a young person who's having trouble at school or at home or with their friends. They're failing to launch and you don't know what to do. They're struggling with challenges. It could have started with some trauma at home or at school, a death in the family, who knows? Maybe something more subtle than that. But now they can't stay in school or they can't keep a job. Maybe they're abusing substances. Maybe anxiety has now tripped them into a place that they're not functioning. Since 2006, adolescents, emerging adults, and their families have trusted Yellow Brick to find healing. They're in Evanston. Clinician scholars there offer hope to these young people. Yellow Brick integrates neuroscience in relationships. They really do heal the brain. They transform lives. They teach life skills. They get them going again. Call 847-869-1500. Call 847-869-1500. You know that young person. I want you to help them. Visit yellowbrickprogram.com. It's 226. Violetta, I've asked you to sort of read from the text line on this topic of what De Niro said at the Tonys last night. He said he doesn't like the president. What are you reading on our text line, by the way?
Very similar. Something's 630. Trump acts like an idiot all the time. He deserves this. Trump spent years trashing Obama, and now he can't handle it. Some people, though, agreeing. 815, good for De Niro. 815 also just wish they hadn't bleeped it out.
Wish they hadn't bleeped it out?
Yeah, I guess they wanted to hear it.
That is not an option. Was it on ABC last night? ABC would be in big doo-doo. They would be in big trouble. I don't even know if you can say doo-doo anymore. They would be in big trouble if they did not bleep that out. I mean, really, the world has not changed that much since the Super Bowl. Since the equipment malfunction, the costume malfunction?
With Justin Timberlake?
Yeah. Janet Jackson. Line 3 is Sandy. You're on WGN. Hey, Sandy.
Hi. Robert De Niro, I lost all respect for him. And he's an actor. I think he could find a bigger vocabulary than just the F word. But I put up with Obama for 8 years, and I really respect the office of the president. And it seems like De Niro and all those like him and that little bunch could respect the office of the president now.
Thanks for the phone call. We go from Sandy to Paul. Hey, Paul, you're on. Hi.
Hey, John, how you doing?
Good, talk to me.
So I'm a huge De Niro fan. I love him, Denzel, Robert, my favorite actor of all time. I don't like it when he does this. We know he hates the president. We get it. We know it. The F-bombs all the time, no matter where you see him. He didn't need to be doing this and using that spotlight for this yesterday. I remember a time when, and I wasn't a big Obama supporter, but you know, he's my president. And I have to respect my president, my office, because without my respect and the respect of other people, how do they do their job? How could they focus on their job? You don't like them, fine. But I don't like it when they use the TV in the limelight to promote their agendas. Not a big fan of it. And it is a turnoff. Is he still my favorite actor? Yeah. I could do without that stuff, you know?
Thanks for the phone call. I'm glad you called. Go, 229. Did you see Rex Hupke's? Listen, I think a lot of this came, it was probably going to happen anyway, but really, on the heels of what happened in Quebec, what happened on the heels of that G7 summit, president wants it to be a G8 summit, you know, there was just all sorts of unrest and ill feelings, and the Sunday talk shows were a mess. And so then the Tonys happened last night, and maybe that was what made De Niro think, okay, I'm going to say something. It's just reached a boiling point. Maybe he was going to say something even if the G7 had gone swimmingly. Rex Hupke had a pretty funny tweet over the weekend. He said, I'm going to get a phone book and call everyone in Canada and personally apologize. To which I retweeted that and then said, what's a phone book? But I think a lot of people were just like, hey, world, hey, France, hey, Canada, we know what happened, but that does not represent all of us. And John McCain was one of the people that said that. We'll do more news next on WGN. Domati, the last time that Kim Jong-un was in the news was when, you know, in a significant way in the United States, was when it was possible that the United States and the North Koreans were at a brink, that we were maybe going to, people were worried about war breaking out. Who knows what would break out? They were launching rockets. The president was lobbing up really testy sort of rhetoric, and it did not seem to be going well. particularly considering the fact that both countries are run by hotheads, and you're like, what's going to happen now? And now, you know, they're going to sit down in a hotel room in Singapore in about 5.5 hours, and maybe things will get a lot better. Here's the image, though, that I want. This is the photo op I want them to do. And I know Violetta will support me on this, because this is our favorite image to come out of North Korea, usually. I want both of them on one of those teeter-totters, standing up. Wouldn't that be awesome?
Standing up seesaws.
They do seesaws, and for some reason in North Korea, I don't know if it hasn't dawned on them that it would be easier to do this sitting down, but in North Korea, they do the seesaws, the teeter-totter, standing up instead of sitting down.
There's a visual I can't get out of my head.
And so I know. And so, you know, I can just see the two of them. Okay, your turn. I don't know who that was.
I feel like President Trump might be like, hold on, I'm not on yet. You're cheating.
You can't cheat in teeter-totters. The only problem with teeter-totters is you can tell who weighs more.
Well, you can mess with the person. You know when you...
Oh, so you jump off and then they fall down. Ha, 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 dotard.
Well, when you're sitting down, too, you can bounce the person if you hit them just right.
I haven't been on a teeter-totter in a while, but yeah, these are all coming
memories.
Back to me. So at the time, we were sort of, you know, giving ourselves a fast education about how strange that place is, North Korea, and that was one of the things that came to mind. They also said that the interpreter, this is the problem for the interpreters, right? And again, so the president and Kim Jong-un and their two interpreters will be in the room, and that they're saying that those will be the only four people there. And my understanding is there will be no recording made of it, and I really wish there was, just so we could hammer out any disagreements after the fact. I mean, heck, when Republicans get into a room with Democrats, they come out and disagree about what was said. But if we had a recording of it, particularly since there'll be a language barrier, then when they said, well, you insulted us, we could say, no.
Right, you misunderstood.
This is what that means in English. You dopes, that's not a bad thing, it's a good thing. There, you don't like it, but here, it was like a nice thing.
But then, could that be a national security threat? Is that some sensitive information these guys would be talking about?
I know that. And you know what else, Domati, I think would happen is, if they both knew that they were being recorded, it would probably impede the sort of candor, the sort of freewheeling negotiation that you'd want, right? Because you may want to make a strong play. Maybe you want to insult him. Maybe you want to cozy up to him. If it doesn't go well, there will be a historical record of this.
Right.
And you are worried about that. So rather than be exposed down the road for having failed through whatever means you tried, you're going to sort of rein it in and be more conservative and careful. And maybe a negotiation like this doesn't require it. It's not Donald Trump's style. So maybe it's best. It's why you don't have cameras in the courtrooms. You don't want them to play to the camera, or at least why we haven't in the past. You don't want them to play to the tape. Better that they negotiate without that recording. But I see it both ways. The value of it would be it could mitigate some disagreements down the road.
Right. But even you've gone in a meeting, maybe even with a boss or with someone important, and you leave, you're like, hold on, what did they say? That was important.
I didn't want to be
rude and write it down.
Right. I know that would be weird. And I'm telling you, these interpreters, what works in one language does not always come through cleanly in another language. Like, literally, when Kim Jong-un called Donald Trump a dotard, we were all like, what? Dude, that's not... we think we know what that means. We certainly know the intent. But if you're trying to score points here,
well,
that doesn't work in America.
But do you want an interpreter to interpret the message or just the words itself? I think it could get in a little bit of a... It could get sticky if you actually want them to interpret the message instead of just the words.
Well, that's the gift of the interpreter, though, because they do have to give some context as they transcribe that information.
Well, but suppose one of them goes all Robert De Niro on the other, right? So in North Korea, all citizens are required to preserve the image of the imperial leader. So if Donald Trump says something that is strikingly insulting, I'm not saying a horrible cuss word, but suppose Donald Trump gets angry and goes off the rail and he's going to try and manipulate him by using some coarse language, the interpreter is now going to have to say in North Korean to the North Korean leader these horrible things. That is a dangerous position for the interpreter to be in. And in the past, when stuff like this has happened, when somebody is saying something impolitic to a leader of North Korea, the interpreters change the words. They tone it down.
This is a much smaller scale than what you guys are talking about, but in sports, we deal with interpreters quite often. So I'm always curious to how much are they distilling? How much are they filtering? Because some of these guys, look, Wilson Contreras got mad that something he said earlier this year was, you know, misrepresented, essentially, and now he uses an interpreter. He used to just talk to us in English, but now he doesn't trust anymore, so he uses an interpreter.
I forget what the deal was. I think it was when Shinzo Abe was talking to, was it Barack Obama, or was it, it might have been Obama's people, maybe it was Trump's people. But, so then they had the interpreter. Abe was speaking, and the interpreter was then saying in English what Abe had said. Her English was terrible. Right? So she's now telling the American people, as presumably she did Donald Trump and his people, or Barack Obama, what Abe said. I didn't know what the hell she was talking about. And this is Japanese. I mean, Japan is much more westernized than North Korea. I would think that there'd be enough of us speaking the two languages, we could do better than that. The interpretation was terrible. When I played it on the radio, my Saturday producer Griffin said, I thought that was a bit. I thought that was a joke, right? Because she was saying things that just were not...
Like, hey, the joke of a bad interpreter doesn't know the language.
Yeah, get a load of this. No, that was the real interpreter, and that was Japan. So really, and this is why Donald Trump's disinterest in studying for this thing, I think, is not as dangerous as it sounds, because... if he knew what he was talking about anyway, it's got to go through his interpreter to Kim, to Kim's interpreter, back to his interpreter, to Donald Trump. Well, by that time, it could be, we're taking you out because we think your arm is sore. And you go, well, now that doesn't make any sense.
I wonder if the president will look at his interpreter and be like, hey, say something nice to him. I don't know exactly what, just say something nice.
Whatever it is, however you guys say nice suit.
Just like, what if you can't even think of something to say, be like, hey, say something insulting. Pick something, now.
I can't wait to see what happens with this.
Now, this is far less important, but thinking about all of this, how did Dennis Rodman and Kim Jong-un build a friendship then? What was that conversation like?
When Kim Jong-un was studying in Bern, I read today, and was learning his studies in German, by the way. It's not sure that he's knowledgeable in English, fluent in English. In fact, I'll go to that point in a minute. He decorated his dorm room with Chicago Bulls memorabilia. Mm. He was a Bulls fan back in the day. So then Rodman goes over there because the planet is upside down now. So Rodman goes to North Korea, and the two of them have a little sit-down. And Kim Jong-un is beaming. He can't believe that he's meeting a member of the Bulls. It's Dennis Rodman, and he's right here. And so Kim Jong-un, in this moment, chose to speak to Rodman in Korean. It went through an interpreter. You would think that at that moment, if your English was good enough, you'd really want to communicate with your idol one-to-one, not one-to-four. But he was not sufficiently comfortable with his command of English that he went through the interpreter. Well, shoot, that's just Rodman. I mean, what's the worst that could happen? Now imagine you're talking to Donald Trump.
Yeah, but maybe he doesn't want to admit he knows English.
That's what I was thinking,
that's
too.
That's good. Because then Trump goes, this guy's an idiot. And then he goes, dude, I'm hearing everything you're saying.
Yeah.
But it's dangerous also for North Korea, for him to, the American imperialism, everything that they're against. I mean, admitting that you know English is kind of...
The interpreters will be in the hot seat, so we wish them well. And by the way, if you run afoul of the regime in North Korea, they don't just go after you. They go after your whole family. This is true.
Three
right?
generations of punishment.
That's right. So like you, your kids, your grandkids, or you, your parents, your grandparents, we're going to get you on both sides, and you're all going to jail. Why? They have put people in jail in North Korea because they were found to be watching South Korean soap operas on videotapes. You're not supposed to be exposed to Western media or even South Korean media. Do you know when the people of North Korea found out about the summit that's happening today? They found out today. In the last 24 hours, North Koreans were told by state media that their fearless leader is in Singapore and he's meeting with Donald Trump to save the world. They did not know that.
So, meanwhile, we've had a countdown for 2 weeks, I think.
Evidently, they don't get the Fox countdown clock. Tick-tock, tick-tock.
Every second. We're one step closer.
It's 249. All right, so there's something to wait and worry for. We'll come back in just a second. Kevin, talk to me when we come back about what your thought is on the Supreme Court saying that they're not going to take any further action on the case of the Wright Field rooftop owners. What is it, Lakeview Baseball Club and Sheffield Baseball Club or something like that? There's two organizations. Here it is, Skybox on Sheffield and the Lakeview Baseball Club. I thought the Ricketts owned all those buildings, but evidently two of them are still owned by these independent groups. And when the Ricketts put up that giant right field video board, it blocked their view. And they said, we had an agreement here. And then the Cubs said, oh, huh. And the Supreme Court said that, oh, huh, is going to win. All right, let's talk about that in a minute. Skybox on Sheffield and Lakeview Baseball Club, according to the Tribune, sued the Cubs in 2015. They argued in part that that right field video board the team put up would block their views of the ballpark. They said back in 2004 they came up with a revenue sharing agreement with the Cubs. Now we can't share much revenue because we can't see the field. But Judge Virginia Kendall, a federal judge, dismissed that case. She said that the board was allowed. They could put up that board and block the view, even though they had a revenue sharing agreement, because the agreement allowed for any expansion of Wrigley Field approved by governmental authorities. And the city council said, yeah, you guys can put up a great big right field video board. And so they did.
Yeah, just about everything the Cubs have wanted to do to Wrigley, the Chicago Landmarks Commission and the city have pretty much okayed it for the most part. So if these rooftop owners want to be mad at anyone, it should be
themselves.
The city officials as well that are approving all these expansions at Wrigley.
Everything the Ricketts have done to Wrigley Field and the surrounding area has made that surrounding area and the fan experience better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I feel so screwed if I spent good money.
Sick.
On one of those condos.
I totally get where they're coming from, but the Cubs weren't going to lose this battle.
Well, but at the end of the day, whose building is it? It's the Cubs' building. They can do whatever they want,
right,
as long as the city council allows.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think a bigger deal was that not are we, you know, wrecking the view of the right field condo owners' rooftop, but are we killing the neighborhood or wrecking the, you know, vintage of Wrigley Field?
You don't live too far from there, John.
I hear the organ in between innings.
And how have you noticed the changes?
I think it's fantastic. Yeah. You kidding me? I'm over there all the time.
Right.
I walked Bingo around there last night and this morning because he decided to get fussy at 5 a.m. But enough about me.
I just feel like the Ricketts are going to buy those buildings anyways. Right?
I didn't think there were any left.
Well, I didn't even think this was still going on, because I remember a couple years ago when you know, this was basically their final appeal that got shot down. That was the last gasp. So that's that. At this point, what are they going to do now?
Yeah,
Give in to Ricketts.
Nice view of the. I think what they could do is offer a rooftop view of me walking Bingo and Daisy.
I'd buy a ticket for that.
Bingo and the G7 action stroller.
Now you're just being nice now.
Mesh canopy,
beer and food included in the deal.
In the experience.
I'll tell you what, I could get $40 for you to park in my driveway.
Is it easy out though?
Yeah, it is. But
okay.
$40 are the signs that everybody holds up.
That's a good deal. I've seen some that are even more than that.
Really?
$50. Oh, during the playoffs, it's crazy too.
Well, I think that those people...
So do you do that? Are you one of those guys that holds the easy out sign at the end of his driveway and allows people to do that?
I do not.
You could have the sign be in Bingo's little stroller. You don't even have to hold it. Just stand next to Bingo. He's the one selling the spot.
Sad little dog.
Who's not going to pull in? They might just give you $40. We already found a parking spot. Here's $40.
$40, easy out parking, and a kiss from Bingo. Huh?
That's a deal.
College is paid for. It's 2:57. Ro and Anna stroll in a minute.